That'd be great.
We will call this meeting to order with members who are present. Thank you for being here on time. Members, today we our meeting continues our theme of looking at new ideas, reform ideas. That's why we call this the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. And we're going to start off with a presentation which should be interesting, intriguing, maybe spur a few ideas. From the Byers Healthcare Action Group, we have Carolyn Perry, the CEO of the Byers Healthcare Action Group, with us. And I believe her presentation is ready to go. And am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Perry,
very good, very good. Well, Ms. Perry, if you could state your name and position for the record, and then please proceed with your presentation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much for having me today. My name is Carolyn Perry. I'm the president and CEO of the Byers Healthcare Action Group here in Bloomington, Minnesota. I'm also the board chair of a group called the National Business Coalition for Health based in Washington, D.C., which is a coalition of all coalitions across the country. Again, Representative Galtwelt, thanks for inviting me. I'm here to talk about the purchaser's perspective. I'm here to talk about the purchaser's perspective relative to market-driven solutions for healthcare. First of all, I feel what's really important is to tell you who the Byers Healthcare Action Group is. The Byers Healthcare Action Group has been around for about 20 years. I believe that we have passed out a copy of our brochure, which tells you probably everything you want to know and more than perhaps you want to know in that brochure. I'm not sure if you also got an evaluate survey tool of ours. Yes, you got that as well. I'll be addressing both of those things a little bit in my presentation today. But to get back to who we are a coalition of public and private purchasers of healthcare. And actually, we used to be the Business Healthcare Action Group, but many years ago, the state of Minnesota joined us as a member, and we became the Byers Healthcare Action Group. We've since evolved so that we include more public sector purchasers, and our goal really is to change the healthcare system so that consumers get the care they need at the right place, at the right price, and at the right time. All of us as group purchasers represent employees or people as our constituents, and we believe that we have to work for change on their behalf, so we give them a voice in the marketplace. Our current list of members are here. You can see that we have large employers, smaller employers, public sector employers, all as employer members. You'll notice that we have healthcare supply side vendors as well as our members, and they participate as employers. Even though they're in the world of healthcare and we buy goods and services from them, they are still employers and some of the biggest employers in the state. They face the same problems we do at controlling healthcare expense. We also have affiliate members, and we've opened our doors to affiliate members so that people that are interested in healthcare can participate with us in talking about problems and solutions. The affiliate members are not represented as employers. They're there to hear what we have to say and to work with us as our partners in instituting some of the reforms that we come up with. BCAG is all about defining value in healthcare. There's a lot of talk right now about value in healthcare. I think some people might be a little confused about what it is. What I'm proud to say is since I've been involved with the Byers Healthcare Action Group, we've been very clear on how we define value. And we would achieve value in healthcare if we had aligned purchasers around making decisions based on what would bring value into the healthcare system. That is, we want all purchasers to be asking for the same thing from all of the suppliers we use. The suppliers we use include health plans, and what we want from health plans is to tell us, to demonstrate to us, that they do hold a unique spot in the supply chain and that they bring a specific value to the healthcare supply chain. We want to hold providers accountable. Providers, in our case, we're talking about doctors, we're talking about hospitals, we're talking about ancillary services, we're talking about all those people that the health plans contract with that then provide goods and services through the health plans to people that are buying health care. And ultimately, we want to get consumers engaged in their own health and health care. And so a number of our initiatives are focused directly on the consumer. When I was asked...
Ms. Perry, I'm going to interrupt you just briefly. I think we have a quorum, and I sensed somebody wanted to move the minutes from our last meeting. If Representative Loeffler has reviewed the
Mr.
minutes.
Mr. Chair, I would be glad to move the minutes of, let me get the date here.
February
1st, 2011.
Very good. The minutes having been moved, if there are no comments or corrections, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, and we've approved the minutes. Apologize for the interruption. Please continue.
That's okay. Thank you. When I was asked to speak here today, I felt that it was important to somehow give you the context of what the Buyers Healthcare Action Group really is and what it is we do. And sometimes it's hard because I'm sure you've already heard from a number of people there that the healthcare system is incredibly complex. There are a lot of ideas, a lot of solutions, a lot of people involved in health and healthcare. We all have some very, very good ideas, but we all come at it with slightly different perspectives, and we bring certain biases along with our own perspectives. My perspectives and the comments that I'm sharing with you today on behalf of the Buyers Healthcare Action Group are clearly the purchaser's perspective. And why is that so important that I make that point here today? It's because oftentimes there are others in the marketplace that want you to believe that they are the purchasers of healthcare. And typically, that is the health plans. They are seen as the payers. And while they do, in fact, pay for services that we get through the healthcare system, the real payers at the end of the day is government, employers, and individuals. Really, those are the people, those are the ones that are writing the checks. And oftentimes, the people that are writing the checks don't have a loud enough voice in how healthcare is constructed and delivered, because their money goes into a system, and then the system uses their money, and there are outputs that come out on the other end of the system, and kind of that space in between, nobody ever really knows what happens. And so what we've been trying to advocate for the last 20 years is really around transparency. We think it's critically important that as purchasers of healthcare, we know exactly where our money is going. And so all the programs that we have developed and implemented over the last 20 years have transparency as a key component of that program. So again, let me tell you, purchasers are so important, and I'm again saying this point because the government is the biggest purchaser in the state of Minnesota. Now, oftentimes when you think about the government, you think about the government as regulator. But the reality is the government is a huge employer, and it's also a big consumer of healthcare on behalf of Minnesotans here in the state. And so they are a huge purchaser, and oftentimes they're out there buying on their own. We believe on the private sector as the purchaser that we need to align our initiatives with the government so we can come together as purchasers to buy the same way. If we buy differently, we confuse the marketplace about what it is we really want. So we've done a lot of work to connect ourselves with government programs to buy rationally as private purchasers do. And of course, individuals always kind of get stuck hanging out there because they don't have the benefit of the group buy. Again, if you look at how big the system is, typically the way we can negotiate good pricing is big against big. Big employer against big health plan against big care system. It's all about the size. So the individual sometimes gets stuck out there not getting the deals that they could get if they bought through a group arrangement. We believe that if we really had a functional marketplace, all of the purchasers could get the health care they need at the right time, in the right place, and at the right price. When I talk about the system, if we go to the center of the box, this is what I'm characterizing today as the system. Some might criticize this presentation as being overly simplistic, but sometimes I think we have to be overly simplistic just to make the point. The healthcare system really is the money comes in, oftentimes directly through those purchasers or through brokers and agents, and it's paid through premiums or service fees to the health plans. The health plans residents then contract with a number of different service providers, and I've categorized these pretty simplistically in five different areas as primary care doctors, specialty care doctors, pharmacy, hospital, and diagnostic imaging. The reason I call those five areas out is if you look at the services that are provided, that is, the services that are paid for through insurance premiums, you'll see the proportionate share of each one of those vendors. So these are the heavy hitters. This is where the real money is spent in healthcare. Now, why do I characterize it the way I have it on this slide? It's because the contracts between the health plans and all of those vendors are proprietary. And that's the first place where we don't really see now where our money is going in terms of how much money is flowing to these individual groups. This is all arranged by contract, and those contracts, again, are proprietary. So we really don't know what the allocation difference might be between the different health plans and the relationships between the different vendors. Now, the information that I have there in the black box of services purchased, the percentages that I'm showing are the percentages of the premium spend that were presented to you, I believe, last week by the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. So I'm simply using their information of where the money flows into the system because it should be pretty consistent from buyer to buyer. But ultimately, those are the services that we purchase through the healthcare system. In addition to the services, then, the health plans and individual employers, as well as the government, have hired for additional services, ancillary services. Now, these can sometimes be included and integrated into the plan that you're buying, the health plan that you're buying, or they can be what we say carved out. That is, a self-insured employer may be using the health plan to pay claims, but they might also be using a disease management firm or a shared decision-making group to help them manage the population that they're serving. So that is to say, somebody wants to use a particular service, oftentimes because that service is extremely expensive, we hire people to manage the utilization of that particular service. So now we've added kind of a layer of management onto the services that we're already buying. So it's another layer of expense. The reason I have the box around it represented as I do here is that sometimes we know the cost of these services and sometimes we don't. It depends on how, in fact, they are bundled in the services that we buy, whether or not we carve them out, and the truth of the matter at the end of the day, we aren't always comfortable with whether or not these services are really giving us a return on investment. So we'll say, we'll trust the vendor that we're buying the services from to tell us what the return on investment will be before we make the buy decision, but it's very difficult because of the kind of data that we use to really determine whether or not we're getting the value for our money. Data is a critical and underscoring piece of all of the work that we do. Ultimately, you have to know where your money goes if, in fact, you're going to spend it effectively. And that is what we mean by using market forces in order to influence the market. Now, recognizing that the system, as I characterize it, is set up like this, you can see that all of this or a lot of this is happening within a black box. And the reason I characterize it like this is because we are part of the system, but we are also outside of the system. Oftentimes, I think people think the Buyers Healthcare Action Group is a group of large employers that pushes on health plans in order to decrease the cost of insurance. And the reality is that isn't what we do at all. What we've done, in light of everything I've said to you, is we work with the delivery side of the house to try to build in accountability as well as improve quality around how we spend our money. So it's really hard for me when I'm in the elevator and somebody needs that 3-second overview of what we do to explain what we do because I would have to go into the whole definition of this system, etc. It'd be a lot easier if I could say, well, we're a group of purchasers and we buy together to hold down insurance costs. The reality is that isn't effective in the long term at all. Oftentimes, if you simply negotiate on price, the price then doesn't leave the system. It's simply transferred to another payer outside the system. I'm sure you've heard a lot about the cost shift happening between the government and between the private sector, I think, or between individuals. the money never really leaves the system. The payer or the purchaser just pays a different proportionate share of money into the system based on what kind of cost controls or contracts are currently negotiated. So it is the system that's holding the most of the money. Now, the Buyers Healthcare Action Group, again, to that end, rather than push on price, has been working with the delivery system in order to fundamentally change the way care is delivered. And we do that by requiring transparency to find out, to know, to understand where the value is relative to quality and cost. So, some of the programs that I'll just highlight quickly for you today, because we don't want to go really deep, are... Our biggest program right now is what we call Bridges to Excellence. It's a pay-for-performance program that we work directly with primary care doctors and specialty physicians. We pay them a bonus for good care. Now, that's not the final solution in terms of resolving healthcare issues, but it's taken us a long way in improving care for individuals, and I'll show you some examples of that later. We also have a program called Evaluate. We feel that before, when I was talking about the health plans and the health plans providing certain services, us not really knowing what the value of those services are, we try to get at understanding that by asking the health plans to complete a survey annually. The survey comes from the National Business Coalition on Health, the group that I'm affiliated with in Washington, and it assesses health plans across the country in an apples-to-apples way so that purchasers can compare health plans based on their value within the supply chain. So we ask health plans to tell us what they're doing based on what it is we want to buy, as opposed to buying from health plans based on what they tell us they need to sell. For hospitals, we've been working on patient safety since 2000, actually 1998, when we realized that 100,000 people were dying needlessly as a result of medical mistakes. A national group came together and decided that we needed to do something as business about that, and we created what we called the LeapFrog Group. The LeapFrog Group is a reporting utility that asks hospitals to report to consumers on an annual basis what they're doing in order to alleviate medical mistakes within their facilities. And through all of the research and evidence that was collected by this group, we know that there are four areas that could significantly reduce harm in hospitals. And so, again, we ask hospitals to report to us on that information annually, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Also, BCAG was a very strong supporter and an initial funder of what you might all be familiar with as the adverse events reporting law here in the state of Minnesota. What we've asked hospitals to do in this state, and now other states across the country have emulated us in this area, is we've asked them to report publicly when they've made egregious mistakes. There's a list of 28 things that should never happen in a hospital. Never happen. I'm not talking about just infections here, which happen all the time. I'm talking about things like wrong site surgery, leaving a foreign object in somebody's body, removing the wrong body part, sending somebody home with the wrong baby, things that really should never happen and happen as a result of process flaws within the hospital. We feel it's only fair that those be reported on, because those can truly be eliminated, and it would be a huge benefit to all if at the very minimum we could eliminate those kinds of mistakes. In addition, in our past, we've done several market solutions that we are famous for, actually, nationally and probably locally, and I'll talk just briefly about those as I move forward. So please keep this picture in mind. As I put this presentation together, I said I don't want to offend anybody by being too simplistic, but I just think it's really important that we strip away some of the noise in the system. We just look at it at a baseline for what it is and recognize that people are paying for services, and they really don't know what they're paying for. Bridges to Excellence, the pay-for-performance program, has just a couple important goals. One, we want to improve care for all Minnesotans, and so we chose the areas of diabetes, vascular disease, and depression. What people don't realize when they go to the doctor is that there's incredible variation in outcomes, that is, variation in quality from clinic to clinic, from doctor to doctor. And we feel that people should know where they should go to get the best care. So through Bridges to Excellence, two really important features. One, quality improvement and recognizing and rewarding the physicians that absolutely do the best job. Everybody should know who they are. And secondarily, if you have a condition that is can be appropriately treated by the best, then you should be seeking care from the best. Again, you should be getting the right care at the right place at the right time for the right price. And so this is a program that we put in place to raise the level of purchaser and consumer awareness around the variation in care so that they can go and get the right care. We also felt that it would spark provider competition based on quality results, and it has done that. So our results over the last 5 years with Bridges to Excellence, when we started out, here I'm just comparing the Minnesota average against two of the big healthcare systems. When we started out in the state of Minnesota, where we clearly are better than everyone else, we were pretty low. We were pretty abysmal in our performance in getting diabetics optimal care. And here on this slide, you can see we were sitting right about 6%. That is to say, 6% of diabetics in the state of Minnesota were getting optimal care for their condition. Over the last 5 years, you can see what's happened, and we like to say that this is largely the result of the reporting that we're doing and then the rewards that we're providing. The reporting utility, when it started out, was only going to do it at a very high level. Through our efforts, we got clinics to report at the clinic level, and now our members are pleased to say that they really can, with a fair amount of certainty, send people or advise people on where to go in order to get the best care. The Evaluate survey, this is the one where we measure health plans. On health plans, our goal really is to take evidence-based information and use it to assess health plans. Again, so that we can compare health plans one against another and make sure that when we're spending our money, we're spending it wisely in the way that we should. We also think it's fair to the health plans to align our expectations. Rather than tell every health plan that every buyer wants something different, we feel it's important that we should say, as buyers, and again, that is as the government, as employers, and as individuals, we all ultimately want exactly the same thing. And that's a certain standard of quality. That's a certain level of value that the plans can bring to the supply chain. And if we told the plans that we were all of like mind in that end, then they would know. They'd have a clear idea of what it is we wanted them to do. And so this tool aligns the purchaser standards and expectations so the plans can respond appropriately. We also have some members that use this tool as a pay-for-performance tool for health plans. That is, they use it to manage the performance of the health plans year over year and then either pay them, reward them for a job well done, or perhaps hold back some of their money if, in fact, the plan hasn't performed as well as they had hoped. This, is, as I mentioned before, is a national tool that we've brought to the state of Minnesota, and so we have coalitions across the country that are looking at about 150 plans across the country and comparing them side by side. The coalition here, that is the Buyers Healthcare Action Group, in working with the supply side of the industry then, uses this information that we cull out of this particular tool to work deeper within the delivery system and the health plans as our partners to resolve issues that affect the community overall. So one of the areas that we might identify through the Evaluate survey is that we're not doing so well in our area of disparities. We might find that people in certain segments of our communities aren't getting access to the care they need. And so collectively, with all the plans, with all the purchasers in the state, we can then put together a plan in order to address that particular inequity. Leapfrog and adverse events, I mentioned before, is our goal is really to reduce preventable medical mistakes and increase the quality and affordability of care. We want hospitals to publicly report the information so that the consumers can make informed decisions about where they get their care. This isn't about pointing fingers at who's doing bad. It's about shining the light on those that are doing exceptionally well. And I'm pleased to report that we have three hospitals in the state of Minnesota that are on the list of, I think, 30 across the country that are top hospitals relative to this survey. Those are the Children's Hospitals in Minneapolis, the Children's Hospital in St. Paul, and Mayo St. Mary that was recognized and rewarded this year for being the nation's top hospitals. We also feel that consumers need to reap the benefits of making smart healthcare decisions. So before, when I was talking about that consumer engagement piece, which is very much a part of who we are, we want our consumers to be able to use this information, and we do that in some cases by incenting them in making the right decision by going to the better performing hospitals. Ultimately, you see that coming up in a lot of plan designs right now, where we do incent the consumer through lower copays, etc., when they go to a better performing practitioner or institution. Now, here's an example of the LeapFrog survey, and you can all go out to this if you want to. It's LeapFrog Group, all one word, .org, and you can look up the Minnesota hospitals and find out how the Minnesota hospitals are performing relative to what's important on the LeapFrog survey. And this is just an example of a screenshot of what you'd find on the LeapFrog website. I alluded to a couple of our other market successes in the past. Choice Plus is the one that we are most notably recognized for. And this was back in the olden days when we were first formed. This would have been back in 1988 when we first came together as a coalition. Our goal then was to quit purchasing irrationally. We recognized that employers, what we did was we moved our employees to different health plans every year, because one health plan would get expensive, and then we'd move everybody to another health plan that would get expensive, and then we'd move them again. And by doing so, we disrupted the relationship between the doctor and the patient. And we really weren't saving any money in doing that. So we decided we were going to change the way we played the game. So these buyers, first of all, came together and changed the way we bought health care. And we said we wanted to buy it based on quality, we wanted total transparency, and we wanted the consumers engaged so they too could see, again, where the best quality providers were. That program became the basis for the state employee plan. So it is a tiered program. It shows you where the doctors are in terms of their cost and quality. You make elections, and you make elections based on copays, and those copays are often structured around who are the higher quality, better performing organizations. So our idea there then was the newest thing ever. It was before there was ever a consumer directed plan. This was the first consumer directed plan in the nation. It was the first tiered program. Medica owns the Choice Plus program now. And actually, this model that we built back in, we rolled it out in 1992, has become the model for changing the delivery system for the nation. BCAG also created the National Data Cooperative. One of the things we realized is we really didn't have enough of our own information to figure out what it was we were spending our money on and how we might spend it more wisely. So a bunch of our members got together and decided to aggregate their data, of course in a blinded fashion, because we aren't interested in finding and eliminating people that might not be healthy. This was really more around where are people getting the best care, how are we spending our money, and how might we incentivize the delivery system to do better. We created the National Data Cooperative, and we ended up releasing that to Watson, or Towers Watson, who now operates it nationally for employers. The other success that we've had as a market-driven example was this idea of bringing purchasers of all types together under one roof to agree on what it was we were going to do as purchasers. As purchasers, we shouldn't be asking for all different things. We all have the same end goal in mind, and therefore we should be working with the industry so that they know what that end goal is. As the purchaser, we should, as the customer, we should be very clear on what our goals and expectations in making the buy are. And so the Smart Buy Alliance, which was originally the broad alliance of purchasers, brought together purchasers from every sector, every segment of the employer, government, Taft, Hartley. We all came together to sit at a common table and talk about how were we going to behave differently. Eventually, that group then became what we know as the Smart Buy Alliance when the governor announced that he wanted to work with us in order to infuse this rational purchasing behavior into the marketplace. My final point here is really that the state of Minnesota is the biggest purchaser in the state, both for the employee group as well as through the Medicaid programs. Now, you have a lot of other purchasers then here in the state that want to work with the state as purchaser to make sure that our goals are aligned in how we purchase. We want to purchase rationally. We want to be smart in what we buy. We want to know how we spend our money. We want to hold our vendors accountable to provide the services that we need at a price that we can afford. And so purchasers, public and private, have to align performance expectations to eliminate waste and redundancy. We should all be asking for the same thing. Now, here's one of the asks that I would make. On the transparency, all of our programs, as they would be, as purchasers, everything we do is voluntary. We can only ask someone to comply. We aren't a regulatory entity. We have no interest in being a regulatory entity, nor do we really embrace mandates. However, sometimes we do need the assistance of the big purchaser so that we're all working together in lockstep to get what we need. So an example of some of the programs that I mentioned and their current performance or successes based on that voluntary performance are these. First of all, in Bridges to Excellence, we currently have, let's say there's about 623 clinics across the state. We now have 593 of those clinics reporting through the reporting utility, a community-wide reporting utility, for the information that we use in Bridges to Excellence. That's an outstanding rate. Now, independently and voluntarily, we got it to about 470 on our own. But we got those additional 100-plus clinics as a result of the state embracing this effort and making reporting mandatory. Now, that meets the needs, ultimately, of all the consumers in the marketplace, because once we have a full set of data, people can then see the data and make choices. We aren't saying that we're necessarily going to reward or punish anybody that's participating, but certainly the transparency is a boon to all of us. In LeapFrog, we had 100% hospital participation when we rolled this out in 2004. I remember attending the meeting with the governor at the time where he had a Patient Safety Day proclamation, and we were all very proud that we were really the first state in the country to have 100% participation. Over the years, the purchaser hasn't stayed particularly vigilant in its requirement to have this information put out there publicly, and we've seen participation drop off to 16% in 2010. In Evaluate, we had 100% participation of our plans, and here I need to make the point that in the state of Minnesota, we really only have 4 health plans that we're asking for information from. In other markets where they use this tool, there will be as many as 30 health plans that they ask and get that information from. In this state, we ask 4, and we get participation from 2. And so we would ask that the purchaser in the public sector join with us to help us implement these market solutions so that we can get more information on how, in fact, the people that write the check are actually spending their money.
Thank you, Ms. Perry. We'll take some questions first. Representative Grunhagen.
Ms. Chair, or Madam Chair, and Ms. Perry, excellent presentation. I really appreciate it. So basically, just a couple quick questions. You've dropped down to 2 hospitals participating. So, you know, why aren't they participating?
2 plans in Evaluate?
Yeah.
Okay. Madam Chair and members. They aren't participating because it is a really labor-intensive process.
So cost.
There's a lot of work. And so what they tell us is that they don't have the resources or the money in order to participate. The 2 that do participate, in the interest of transparency, are Preferred One and Health Partners. The 2 that don't participate are Medica and Blue Cross.
Madam Chair, just a
Representative
follow-up.
Grunhagen.
Then if I understand this correctly, I go back to this graph you had here. And we'll just use Medicare and Medicaid. When a dollar comes from those programs and goes into this rectangle here you have drawn, we don't really know what happens to that dollar. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Ms. Perry.
Okay. And
Representative Grunhagen.
Madam Chair. So would, in your opinion, does it happen, based on my understanding, the accounting method that's used by these, I think it's 8 vendors that provide these services inside, you know, these health plans, they're using an NAIC accounting method, which is difficult to track the money, which is used as an insurance in the insurance industry. If they move to a GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles method, would that be helpful in tracking where the money is actually going?
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair, members, I really am not commenting on exactly how they do the accounting within the system. I'm instead talking about the transparency in terms of where the money flows to which particular entities. Let me give you an example of how I'm talking about this. Right now, each one of the health plans negotiates contracts with each one of the providers within the system. We don't know how much. So there's variation in the services that we're buying. So let's say Blue Cross and Fairview have a relationship. They have a contract. The value of that contract will look different to the purchaser than the value of a contract, let's say, between Health Partners and Fairview. So at any given time, we aren't sure what the spend is for Fairview. What we're saying is we think it would be helpful for us to know not only how much is going to Fairview, but to what end, to what services. And it's hard to make an evaluation on a return on investment when you don't know how those dollars are being invested. So it's a larger sense than the actual accounting practice.
Representative Grunhagen.
Madam Chair, Ms. Perry. Yeah, my understanding is with a GAAP accounting method that you would be able to determine that better. Now, that's, you know, the information I've been given. So I guess I'd need more information to exactly see how that would be done. But obviously, when we look at your diabetic optimal care scores, transparency creates dramatic results to the good for both the patient, the medical system, and the outcomes. And here we have a system where, in my opinion, billions of dollars are flowing into, and we don't know what's happening to those dollars as they go in there in terms of transparency. To me, that is ripe for waste, fraud, and abuse when that type of system exists where billions of dollars flow in. And I think we should address that and find out where that's going. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Perry, excellent presentation. Thank you so much. My question is, with the success of your programs, such as Bridges to Excellence and Evaluate and Leapfrog, is your group able to identify or be an advocate for some to mitigate medical malpractice suits?
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the medical malpractice issue, I believe in my heart, isn't as big an issue as we say it is, particularly here in the state of Minnesota. Ultimately, I think if you don't have the accidents, you don't have the lawsuits. Having been a risk manager for 20 years of my life before I took this job, we did all that we could to control our mistakes and our accidents to ensure that there weren't lawsuits that followed. So I'm not sure that the medical malpractice necessarily drives the behavior. I do think that there's an opportunity for just pure quality improvement in order to eliminate waste in the system.
Representative McDonald?
No, very good. Thank you.
Okay. Members, just to let you know, we have Franson, Huntley, Barrett, Benson, Loeffler, Moran, and Quam. So that makes Representative Franson next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Pear. Thank you. I wish I would have been here for the beginning. I'm sorry I was in another meeting, but what I caught was extremely interesting. I'm just questioning. I just would like to know, the state of Minnesota is the largest purchaser of health care. Is that the same in every state? So is New York the largest purchaser of health care as well as every state, or how is Minnesota rate with the rest of the United States?
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, actually that is pretty consistent across the country, that the state is the largest buyer of health care in every state. And if we look nationally too, the federal government obviously is huge because it buys for all the federal employees as well as the federal programs.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Ms. Perry, two questions. One is, what do you evaluate when you evaluate health plans? I mean, if I can see what you evaluate, if somebody's not getting the diabetic care they ought to get, is that is that the clinic's responsibility or is the plan's responsibility? And what do you evaluate with the plans?
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we evaluate different things with the health plans. When we talk to the health plans about what we want to look at for them, it really is, again, their value in the supply chain. What we've heard from some of the health plans is that clinical care is provided by the doctors at the clinics, and they aren't necessarily responsible for that. But then what we also hear is that one of the things we buy from the health plans is their ability in order to manage the care, the quality of the care that's coming out of the providers. So we are a little confused about that. So what we've tried to look at within the evaluate survey is what specifically is the role of the health plan in helping the provider deliver the best clinical care. And that might come by way of management reports, of data, of a certain reimbursement. As we move toward the area of accountable care organizations, perhaps the relationships between the plans and the providers might change so that the plans become more of a supplier to the providers around data and information to make them more effective at care delivery. The evaluate survey that you all have talks specifically about, I feel like Vanna White, I'm sorry. It talks specifically about what the evaluate survey is, how long we've used it, and then it does have a comparison chart which will show you the domains that we measure and how plans are performing.
And
Representative Huntley?
Madam Chair, my other question relates to the state was just awarded last fall the Advanced Primary Care Demonstration Project, which will require us to have more than half the people in a particular area doing the same kind of purchasing. So that means we will have to have the self-insured, basically, which I think most of your members are self-insured. Are they willing, are they going to participate, and how is that working out?
My
understanding that's ready to roll out in July.
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, you are my plant in the audience, I fear. I say that jokingly, but the reality is this is exactly the conundrum that we have when you have private sector and public sector perhaps working on different things. If, in fact, you're going to get a market change, you need everybody working together to make sure that that change happens. We convened a meeting of the Buyers Healthcare Action members and the state of Minnesota last year already, called in the plans to ask how, in fact, if we were going to pay a care coordination fee on top of, were we going to be paying a care coordination fee on top of all the expenditures that we were already paying, or how would we reallocate money from other programs so that we could spend it on care coordination rather than those services that we're buying somewhere else? The answer was not clear. The answer still is not clear. I can tell you that it has been the Buyers Healthcare Action Group's intent all along to put money into the delivery system rather than put money in the hands of third-party vendors to manage things that aren't done. So it would be our goal and in everybody's best interest to put the money at the point of care. So we have every interest in doing that. But it can't be an add-on program. It needs to be a reallocation. So right now, let's take disease management as an example. If disease management really isn't giving us a return on investment, then we should shut down every disease management program and reallocate that money and give it to the clinics where they're doing particularly great care in the form of medical homes.
Thank Representative you. Huntley? Representative Barrett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. White / Perry, I have a question for you. Vanna, I'm sorry, bad joke.
Oh, sorry, see, I'm already past that.
I too want to congratulate you for the performance of your program, specifically the Bridges to Excellence. Looks here that you had significant performance improvement in 5 years. Part of that, obviously, is with the depression area that you've been working with. That's part of the Bridges to Excellence program. I don't mean to put you on the spot. You may or may not know, but can you describe that portion of the program and what you found to be most effective as it relates to evidence-based practices dealing with depression and mental health?
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair, members, the depression program was actually developed, without getting too much in detail, we have a multi-stakeholder group that works on the design of the Bridges to Excellence program, so it's not just a bunch of employers hanging around playing foosball and saying, let's check this one out. We really do get a lot of advice and information from stakeholders in the marketplace. So there was a project that we were already working on in the state through the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, and that was a program called Diamond. You may have heard testimony on it already, but they were doing a lot of work around care coordination for people with depression. And one of the foundations of that program was the use of an instrument called the PHQ-9, which is a list of 9 questions that you ask a patient when they come in the doctor's office. And then based on how they score on that instrument, you determine whether or not that person has depression. If in fact they're so what we did, how we based our program was really aligned with their program in that we wanted primary care physicians to know about the PHQ-9 tool, to use the instrument, to report having used the instrument, and then demonstrate that within 6 months of evaluating a patient that they would have that person in remission in that 6 months, so that people with depression were A, identified, and B, helped to get out of depression.
Thank you. And then a follow-up related to that, if I may.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Perry, as it relates to disease management, chronic illness, and the need to potentially carve out parts of those programs where it makes sense, and how alcohol and chemical dependency is viewed as opposed to other chronic illnesses such as cancer. And so what? How do you make those determinations as it relates to one chronic illness compared to another?
Ms. Perry.
From a cost-benefit perspective.
Ms. Perry. Madam Chair and Representative, your question is about how do we select which conditions we choose?
Representative Barrett.
Madam Chair, Ms. Perry. My question is, how do you evaluate the effectiveness of certain disease management conditions compared to other conditions?
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative, this is truly a difficult area. Typically, when we go in and we ask for services, we identify, first of all, what are the biggest conditions within our own demographics. So we'll look at the population and see where our biggest spend is and what, in fact, we can do to help people. In the areas of, we know that certain chronic conditions can be treated in a certain way. We also know that certain chronic conditions can be avoided. And so it depends on how much work that we can do with the patient. A lot of disease management programs have as their underpinnings working with the patient so that they change their behavior so that they can help themselves in their treatment to get better. So in those cases, you'll have a disease management person that will, in fact, work with the patient to get them better. Typically, the way they work is you'll spend a certain amount of money per patient to have that offering, and then at some point they'll report back based on outcomes and spend whether or not that person got better, and you look to your vendor to provide that information. I think right now, from what I hear from our members, not a lot of people are seeing the return on investment from those particular disease management programs. In the area of cancer, a lot of the work now is being done in the area of shared decision making, so that people are selecting the appropriate options through the different kinds of preference sensitive care in terms of the treatments that they see. And ultimately, what you're looking for is cost effective outcomes on behalf of the patient. Did they get well at the appropriate cost, and were the appropriate services utilized? So it's an ongoing evaluation to really see whether or not you're getting the return on investment of any of those programs that you're using.
Representative Barrett, we have about 10 minutes left, members, for questions.
Quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Perry, is there a standard that is out there that in which to uniformly determine whether a particular type of program is effective or not, especially as it relates to chemical dependency?
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative, I am not sure.
Follow-up, Representative Barrett?
No, thank you.
Okay. Representative Benson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Perry, this is exciting information. I've got a follow-up to Representative Grunhagen's line of questioning in terms of transparency. It is exciting to see how many people were initially involved with some of your programs. It would be nice to see them get re-involved and see greater participation. But particularly the two that have entered into sharing information regarding their contracts, the ones that don't, my question was, and it's kind of maybe hoping that it would continue on a little bit, is the reason why they give that they don't proprietary? Why don't they share that information?
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's different kinds of information, some that's shared, some that isn't. The information that typically isn't shared is within the contractual relationships between the different providers, and I think obviously the concern is their antitrust, number one, and there is a fear that if you're too open around the cost of services that all of the vendors will ultimately move toward one particular cost and therefore inflate the overall cost. And so people are very, very nervous about how much information you share just based on a usual market dynamic that's in play. As it relates specifically to the Evaluate tool, and we're asking people to respond to what it is we do, we've found the difference in opinion between the plans that do and the plans that don't is really largely based on performance. Those that are performing well and feel that they can use the information to demonstrate they're performing well do, in fact, use the tool. And typically, in fairness to those that participate, when they use the tool for their internal strategic planning and their quality improvement, they obviously do perform better when they do the report card.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Perry. I totally agree with the basic premise that we ought to use data-driven decisions and we really ought to focus on outcomes. But I have a disconnect when you say we're all paying for the same thing and should all pay and ask for the same thing, because we're not all serving the same populations. And we in our public programs, which is what our responsibility is, the billions of dollars that we pay in medical assistance and JMC and its successor and in Minnesota Care are dealing disproportionately with people with comorbidities, like Representative Barrett mentioned, multiple diagnosis, they're low income, that creates its own health disparity issues. They're disproportionately disabled and frail and very sick elderly, which are very different than the typical private insurance market. And I'm concerned that we need to have perhaps another hearing. It's too bad our full chair isn't here, because I think we need a hearing just on how quality data influences our purchasing as a state. And for example, Bridges to Excellence, which I think is a good product perhaps for the private sector, when DHS, we contribute a fair amount of money out of our state budget to the overall pool that supports Bridges to Excellence and all those clinics. But DHS set up a separate pool just for clinics and providers in the fee-for-service part of our MA system. And what they found out was and you could get up to $500 per eligible person, so not a tiny amount. It wasn't $10 or $12. It was $500. And in the first year, they only had one clinic that earned $125. And in the second year, they didn't even have anyone who applied. And sometimes the data that's gathered and it's used in national or private sector things is based on people who are continuously enrolled and see the same provider for 18 months or 24 months. That's not the typical care pattern of the people we serve. And so I think we really need to drill down into this so that we're actually using the data-driven decision-making and seeing whether or not where it does fit for us and where it doesn't, because we're actually investing a lot of money right now as a set-aside, and I really want to see quality outcomes because we're paying a lot with those billions of dollars. And so I hope that we'll have another one, and if you have some insights to add, but I really do think our population, our outcomes are different. Our goal isn't just medical treatment of a particular healthcare condition. It's about stabilizing that person's life so they remain employed. They don't have to fall on public assistance. They don't lose their housing and go into publicly paid shelter. I mean, we have a broader set of measures than just did you do the right tests at the right time for a particular health condition. And I'm hoping that we can get more sophisticated. And it's not a criticism of how it's working for the private sector. It's just I'm not sure it's the best fit for us in the public sector.
Ms. Perry?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I completely agree that there are always going to be outliers that need extra services and much more assistance than they're currently getting. One of the things I have to say, though, about the Medicaid program participating as part of Bridges to Excellence has really been would I say, enlightening, and it's given me great hope. I remember when we first started the program, and we were the first, and we're still the only state that has Medicaid participating in a pay-for-performance program such as Bridges to Excellence. I think the concern initially was that we weren't going to be able to get community clinics because they were dealing with a tougher population to be able to provide and achieve the outcomes that we were looking for from Bridges to Excellence. But I'm pleased to say that over the years, some of the best-performing clinics are, in fact, those community clinics. They are giving the absolute best care to a really underserved population, and I guess it warms my heart to see that we can make that happen.
Representative Loeffler?
Just to follow up on that, that's absolutely true, and I think we have to have the knowledge base go not just from mainstream to specialty clinics, but back and forth, and I don't think that the insights and knowledge of what led to those wonderful outcomes has necessarily been transferred to the rest of the clinic system, and I think we have to figure out ways to get that two-way street going, because it's about a whole bunch of different things.
Representative Moran?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Perry. Thank you for the presentation, very informed, as informed as I can get or be trying to learn this whole system. You have no real information here that is all good. But sometimes I feel like I'm some of the clients that we, some of the community that we represent, the low income, the elderly, the disenfranchised community, trying to figure their way through this whole process. So my question is probably is out of the range of everyone else's question, which is what is, because you have an excellent pool of employers who are members here. Fantastic. And I was just wondering, what is the criteria for becoming a member?
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the criteria really is that you're a purchaser of health care in the state of Minnesota. Beyond that, it's a matter of just being able to afford the dues to participate.
And what is the dues?
The lowest level of dues is $2,500 for the smallest organization. Right now, the highest amount of dues is $10,000 for the largest organization, and those are people that come in as employers.
And
Representative Moran.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I notice you have a lot of big employers, and I don't see many small businesses. And I was just wondering why.
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the hardest thing for us, at least for me, and if anybody has a good marketing background and can help me with this, we have a really hard time explaining what our value proposition is because of what we do. Again, so much of the focus is on whether or not you can negotiate low prices in buying health care that people really aren't paying attention to what's going on behind the scenes on the other side of the black box with the delivery system. We feel that it's so important to engage and involve other purchasers in changing the delivery system, but people really don't understand that, and it's been a really hard sell for us. The people that typically understand it is a self-insured employer because they've done a lot of work in opening the black box and in managing the way the money flows and how they hire vendors and what they do and some of the innovations they make in their programs. So they understand it a little more than perhaps some of the fully insured and smaller employers.
Representative Moran.
And so my question is, because I think it's really, really important that we engage small businesses because we have a whole population of people who are left out of the process, and when we don't, my hope is that you can find a way to make it clear so that they can understand the benefits of that, if there is benefits for them to be a part of this process. And my hope is that it's not just the dues to become a member.
Do you want to respond to that, or we'll move to our last question?
I want to say thank you, and if you can give me any guidance, I would really appreciate it.
And last question, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Perry. I'm trying to gain a better insight. Can you let me know what proportionality do you think is from the transparency or people are watching, and what is the benefit or consequences from the mechanisms, questions, protocols, the quality system instantiated in order to be able to gain the information to report?
Ms. Perry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the biggest change, where we see the biggest change, is in the transparency in and of itself. Everybody wants to post good results, and what we find a lot when you put transparency to any system, particularly in the provider performance area, is that providers really use the information to look at one another and then to assess how they're doing against their peers, and that's probably where you get the biggest boost, even more than the boost that you get from giving them additional money. However, I will say that that when you put performance dollars to particular areas, depending on the size of the performance dollars, you will change behavior of the providers. I think the classic example on that is generic prescribing.
Representative Kwan?
That's good.
Okay, with that, thank you, Ms. Perry, for a very informative and interesting presentation. And with that, we will move to, I'll introduce Dr. Wood from the Mayo Clinic. And members, I think that when we talk about health reform, Mayo Clinic always rises to the top, and so I look forward to this presentation. So if you would introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Dr. Douglas Wood. I'm the Vice Chair of the Division of Healthcare and Policy and Research at Mayo Clinic. I also chair the Quality Academy at Mayo, and that is the part of Mayo that teaches all aspects of quality improvement and quality management. Besides that, I actually happen to be a practicing cardiologist, so I take care of patients as my primary job. So today, I would like to share with you some insights about where we go from here. It's a privilege, actually, to follow Ms. Perry, and I'll go back to the 1992 time frame when her organization first started. It really was an important part of evolution of healthcare delivery and payment in Minnesota. It was a time when we actually began to say we need to start paying for results. Now, despite all the work that Minnesota has done, as we look at the circumstances we're confronting, and I think you heard them explained in Ms. Perry's presentation, the fundamental problem for us is that healthcare spending is still rising at a rate that outpaces economic growth. And that's what's causing a tremendous pressure on your budgets at the state. It's what's causing tremendous pressure for businesses, both large and small, and it's causing trouble for every family in the state. We heard a discussion of value, and Ms. Perry actually described it from her perspective. And I might offer a slightly different vision, but value actually is getting health for, as was mentioned earlier, a reasonable amount of spending. Now, we've worked at payment reform, but I will say that payment reform alone will not get us to where we need to be. We've done some work on delivery reform, and that, too, won't quite get us to where we need to be. If we go back to where we were in 2007, there was a lot of work done with the Governor's Transformation Task Force and with the healthcare's, with the legislature's Healthcare Access Commission. We came out of that with some really large recommendations. We've implemented some of them, but not all of them. So there are some ideas that are left that if we, I think, keep in our minds, we can bring back to bear fairly quickly in a way that might make some progress towards solving some of these problems. You can put all of this together from my perspective and say that it becomes an economic issue, because if we don't solve this problem, we're really going to threaten the economic vitality of every community in the state. Now, what does this mean for Minnesotans? The costs of family coverage have more than doubled in a few years. Family budgets are under pressure. Not only is the cost higher, but copays are higher, deductibles are higher, and coverage is thinner. So you're paying more for less. And insurance offerings from employers, especially those that are really tight, smaller employers in particular that have fewer resources, are becoming fewer. When we think about Minnesota healthcare spending as a state, it is true that our spending is lower than the national average on a per capita basis and that we spend less of our GDP for healthcare, but that's not going to last. Because when you look at healthcare spending projections that come from the Department of Health, we're projecting some fairly substantial increases in the rate of spending, and it will make it difficult for us to sustain the successes that we've achieved in the past. And spending on the public side is growing faster than it is on the private side. Now, this graph shows you annual spending per person by payment source. This information comes from the Minnesota Department of Health Health Economics Program, and it begins to raise some questions for us. Now, in her presentation, Ms. Perry made the point that we need to make sure that everybody in Minnesota gets the right care at the right time, at the right place, at the right price. That should be the case for every Minnesotan. What this graphic begins to suggest to us is that there are differences. Now, there are some reasons, and very good reasons, why there are differences in these numbers. But there should not be any difference in the expectation that the delivery system in particular will provide the right care at the right time at the right place. And we can then negotiate what the right price might be or discuss what the right price might be. But as a quality person, when I look at variations, I start looking at opportunities. And so this tells me then that there are opportunities, in fact, that we can pursue that might improve our delivery. Now, this graphic summarizes one of the important
Me, Dr. Wood. Yes. Members, I know on that last slide that some of the numbers are just missing from the copies, and so we'll make sure that those get emailed out to members so you have all that information in full.
I apologize for the missing. Now, when we talk about averages, as we typically do in some of these discussions, it's important to remember that sometimes important points get lost. And in this particular circumstance, in medical assistance, the disabled and the blind, which I've circled here on the spending side, are a smaller percentage of the enrollment, but they have greater needs. So I think Representative Loeffler, in fact, made this point earlier. When we start looking at these things, we have to have the capability that we can respond to individual patient needs in a most effective way. Now, if we think about our public spending, it is, I think, reasonable to say that the cost increases that we're looking at have been driven by changes in enrollment, the impact of loss of insurance coverage that drive people into public programs, as well as medical cost inflation. And a question might come here, what is medical cost inflation? And that's the increase in spending that occurs because of decisions that are made at the point of care. That is doing things that you don't necessarily need to do. And I will provide some examples of that a little bit later on. Our per-person spending in the MA program is high. Again, there are reasons, but again, it's an opportunity for improvement. Our long-term care costs have been reasonably well managed by some fairly aggressive efforts, but because the age group over 85 is the fastest growing segment of our population, this is an area where there will be some increased pressures and we'll have to find some really good solutions. And I will emphasize again that if we only do this on the delivery side or we only do this on the payment side, it will not be sufficient. We need a combined effort. So what have we tried so far? We've tried price controls, principally in the Medicare program, sometimes in the Medicaid program, and some commercial plans have tried price controls. We've tried bundled payments. They've been successful in some circumstances, especially for inpatient care in the Medicare program. And we've tried restrictive networks. And restrictive networks may or may not work very well. The carve-outs that were referenced in the first presentation, in fact, may contribute to higher costs by being a barrier to having individuals able to access the best care in places that otherwise would be considered out of network. But why don't price controls work? The important thing we have to recognize here is this concept of total cost of care. And those of us who were involved in sort of the work in 2007 getting ready for the 2008 legislative session and the Governor's Transformation Task Force remember this concept of total cost of care. So the leverage here is actually the use rate. So you can talk about the total cost of care as being the unit price times the use rate. In the Medicare program, in 1997, an attempt was made to try to manage the price, the individual price of services, to control spending. And this was called the Sustainable Growth Rate, or the SGR, and that's a particular program that has actually caused a great deal of consternation on the part of the American Medical Association and other physician groups. But in the years 1997, in the orange bar, physician fees rose on an average of about 3.4% per year. Our annual spending, total spending in the Medicare program, rose at about double that. Now, the SGR actually required that after a while of increased spending, there had to be applied a correction to try to get the total spending down. And in a complex formula, basically what that says is we're going to reduce the unit price and hope that that will reduce the spending. So in 2001, when the first reduction came, spending on a total basis did not decline. And the reason simply is that in order to make up the loss of income on units, you just generate more units. And so this is an issue whether you're talking about individual units. It will be also an issue when we start thinking about bundled payments or episodes of care. It's okay to talk about episodes of care, but you also have to find a way that you can control the number of episodes of care. So what's the reality? Our resources truly are finite. We already have strong efforts underway in Minnesota, and those efforts are ones that would serve us well in moving forward. Many people have asked me in the last 2 days, especially since Judge Vinson's ruling in Florida, what do we do now? The answer is we keep going, especially in Minnesota. Because in Minnesota, we were ahead of the federal government all the time. There's no reason for us to step back and wait and decide that we're going to be slower than the federal government. We do have to do more work to encourage providers to create value and affordable care. And I don't have to say anything more about them than what Ms. Perret said earlier. And we have to find ways for everyone to have affordable insurance. Now, other people have asked me, what's wrong with the Affordable Care Act? My response to them is that the Affordable Care Act was crafted by people who thought that the answer was in Massachusetts and not in Minnesota. Because in Minnesota, we decided in 2008 that our effort had to be on controlling costs first and then work on access later. Massachusetts decided to do access and not work on cost. So they have coverage, but they truly don't have access, and their costs are rising rapidly. So in that circumstance, then, I think we've demonstrated in Minnesota what we can do, and we have the capability of moving forward from this day on to achieve the real goals. And when we think about what we want health. Ms. Perry talked a little bit about the measures of health. This slide actually tries to describe for you what determines health. And here, health is meant freedom from disease and, in the case of mortality, death. But I will tell you that when we did some research in Austin, Minnesota, by embedding cultural anthropologists in the community as part of some work we were doing with the Mayo Center for Innovation, we learned from the citizens of Austin that health means I can do everything I need to do every day so that the people who depend on me will be cared for or role functioning. That's health. Very important. Now, from this perspective, there are four things here that account for the outcomes: physical environment, social and economic issues, clinical care, that's what I do every day in the office and the hospital, and health behaviors. The important point about this slide is that when we think about what we're doing as a state, and for providers and for businesses, as you've heard, and for legislators and others, we have to recognize that this is a large problem, and we cannot ignore the fact that we have to put everything together. So we can decide we're going to cut health care. We can decide we might cut education, but we have to understand that all of those may have then a magnified outcome. So in this circumstance, all I want to make clear is that this is a complicated circumstance, and we have to think carefully, try not to go for simple solutions that may be attractive when they might have adverse effects elsewhere. As we started work on a project in Austin, Minnesota that I referenced earlier, we began to look at this as an economic imperative. In particular, creating a healthy community means that you have better education, you have a healthier workforce, you have lower healthcare costs, which in turn help to attract businesses and jobs. And that's how you can create and sustain jobs in a community. Now, there are many opportunities in front of us. I, for one, am extremely optimistic about where we can go. In our 2008 work, we adopted a statewide health improvement program that will need to come up for funding later this year. There are some options, I think, for how to manage that, even if we don't have as many state dollars as we would like. The medical home payment program was implemented in July 2010. It has now become a model for Medicare nationwide in the Medicare Advanced Primary Care Demonstration Project. The method of payment that we developed in Minnesota will be used nationally. The Baskets of Care work is work aimed at developing episodes of the payment system. And the question that was raised earlier about how to know where dollars are going in the system, we actually planned for that in 2008 and implemented the method to solve that problem. The Department of Health is working now on the implementation, and that's provider peer grouping. So when provider peer grouping comes up and operational next year, we will be able to know where we are spending our money. We will know where the utilization is in utilization terms. We will know things like the burden of illness of patients. We will know what the spending is. We will know what was paid by a plan. We would be able, with that information, to standardize prices and spending. and began to run models about what logical spending levels should be based on the burden of illness of an individual. So we will have a tremendous resource, and it was the foresight of the folks who put together the 2008 reform package that actually allowed that. The goal of that, we heard about transparency earlier today, the goal of provider peer grouping was in fact to provide the transparency that would make purchasing easier for individuals and for businesses and make policy decisions easier for people like you. So the provider peer grouping resource will be an extremely valuable resource for us when it gets up and running. It's a little behind, it's a huge task, but the Department of Health, I think, will do very well with it. Now, the Affordable Care Act actually creates a number of advantages for Minnesota. In particular, in coming back to the concept of insurance market reforms, the concept of exchanges is one that we, in fact, considered in Minnesota back in the 2006-2007 timeframe going into the 2008 reform. So we considered back then total cost of care, exchanges, and an individual mandate. And the wisdom of legislative leaders at the time, including at least one person in the room, Representative Huntley, was that perhaps we shouldn't push an individual mandate so much until we worked very hard to achieve the other two goals. Now, we didn't quite get those other two goals in the final bill. They were in the Senate file as it moved forward. But in fact, we thought about them. And as I mentioned earlier, those ideas, I think, are still there for us to come back to. The federal program also has in it some demonstration projects, accountable care organizations or ACOs, the Advanced Primary Care Demonstration Project that was referenced earlier, and some community health improvement grants would be available to Minnesota. There are some coverage expansions and subsidies for Medicaid and for those persons earning up to 400% of the federal poverty level. And those, by the way, were not included in Judge Vinson's ruling on Monday. That part of the law was specifically not struck down or invalidated. Now, what do we need to do to move forward? Well, first, I think we have to understand our aims. In particular, we've got to create new delivery systems to create value. We have to create new insurance markets that will, in fact, provide affordable coverage for everyone. And we've got to have a new payment model with the right incentives that will actually help control costs, some of the things that Ms. Perry was talking about, as well as some others. Let me show you some very specific options for us in terms of payment system or payment reforms that we might consider. The first is shared decision making. You actually heard this referred to. But I'm going to use the example of coronary revascularization for angina. This is bypass surgery, for those of you who might know it by that name. In the United States, in a trial that was done that asked patients to make a decision without any knowledge on their part or to make a decision after they were given some information about the outcomes of surgery, it is interesting that 41% of patients decided to have surgery compared to 58% of patients who did not have the information. Now, when you look at the relative difference here, that's a 30% reduction. In all of the debate about the Affordable Care Act, we have heard again and again that the federal government is injecting itself into the physician-patient relationship with rationing. We make rationing decisions every day in an irrational fashion. This is rational medical care, not rationing. It is rational that you do the right thing at the right time, at the right place. Then you can talk about the price again. But if you come back to the comment, then the right thing to do is based on the evidence. Now, the reason you can say this is that we know from looking at large numbers of persons who have coronary artery disease that would require bypass surgery, in a large trial that we did in the United States spanning 10 years, if I start you on medication, or if I start you with angioplasty, or I start you with bypass surgery, at the end of 10 years, you are just as likely to be alive and just as likely to have been free of a heart attack if you started with medication as if you'd started with bypass surgery. Bypass surgery is a whole lot more expensive than medication. And if you opted for angioplasty as an individual, I could guarantee you that there's a pretty good chance, well, I shouldn't say pretty good, there's at least a 2% chance that you're going to have another angioplasty within 6 months because of complications of the device, which only adds to the cost. What I could tell you is you know, you have angina, your prognosis is pretty good. The best evidence we have says we're going to start you on medication, here are the right medications. When the medications fail, then we can come back and think about angioplasty or surgery. Now, as it turns out, especially if you think about Medicare payment, Medicare would pay me more for an hour of my time to do an angioplasty than it would pay me to make the decision to use medication. So if I'm a cardiologist whose income depends on doing interventions, then, as you can imagine, I might be more inclined to do more interventions than I might spend time talking to patients about medicine. That's one of the other problems about trying to control input prices. So in the Medicare program in particular, we've created this huge administrative bureaucracy to try to set input prices with precision, to make sure that we pay for those units of service without thinking about the outcome. The outcome, again, is I'm going to do just as well if I'd gone with simple medications at a lot less cost than I would have if I go with angioplasty or surgery. This is what Carolyn Perret was referring to earlier in terms of making the right decision at the right place and the right time. This is rational health care. This is not rationing. We can do this, but we don't have the payment reform in place and the delivery system reform to be able to do it. Now, mini capitation also offers promise, and the reason for this is it offers a single bundle payment to physicians and hospitals. The reason it offers significant leverage for us is that a small number of people, 1% of the population, accounts for about 30% of our expense. And about 10% of the population accounts for almost 80% of our spending. These are people who have chronic diseases, who end up with hospital care that sometimes could have been avoided. When we were working through this again back in the 2008 time frame, Representative Huntley and others brought several examples from providers across the state in Duluth and Owatonna and others, where we saw the impact of trying to pay for units of service and not think about the outcome. And in patients with heart failure in particular, we didn't get the results that we probably could have because we're paying for an office visit, not for an outcome. We can go back to this. We were starting that way. There is no reason why we can't go to it again. So a few thoughts about where we might go. Minnesota, I think, could create a single statewide exchange. It could be a public-private entity. The Mayo Health Policy Center in 2006 actually made some recommendations for insurance coverage in the United States. And the Health Policy Center then recommended individually owned insurance that would not be dependent on your employment. And then you, as an individual, would have access to government-provided subsidies to help defray the cost of insurance if you did not have the means to do so. Now, Minnesota has a great history of having not-for-profit health plans. And we can work on some of the details of the exchange, whether plans would sell entirely in the exchange or not. But I think the important thing here is to recognize that we had done a lot of work. We, in fact, had hired an outside firm to help with analysis of the exchanges. The legislature had done that work. We could move forward on our own, regardless of what happens at a federal level, and transform the insurance market in Minnesota along with the delivery market. And we should be able to achieve the advantages of providing affordable insurance for families, predictable costs for businesses, predictable costs for government, and we can start working on developing the relationships that will yield long-term value rather than the churn every November that at least some businesses have learned adds nothing more than expense and no value. Along with this, we can create a number of different solutions, and today I'm not going to go into the details, but to simply say another group charged by the legislature to work out the details could, I think, come back with some very effective solutions that would help solve the problems that are in front of us. I would say that if you look at the spending of the health plans that is reported to the Department of Health and look at the details, it is remarkable how much the health plans are actually spending on things like health education. We decided to spend about $47 million on SHIP in 2008. The health plans spend at least that much on health education every year, but we don't have a strategic plan to decide how we're going to spend that. We probably could do better with those dollars that we would spend even in the public sector, in the private sector, I should say. Now, another consideration here is, I think, looking at opportunities to change things like prescribing. I like the black box reference that Ms. Perry used earlier. Here's a big black box. When I sit with a patient and decide that I want to treat their blood pressure, I don't know what their prescription drug plan is, and it will have a big impact for them in terms of how much they might have to pay out of pocket. I have choices. I can choose one of six different medications. I know what the theory tells me I should pick. But if I pick that, it might be excessively expensive for the patient because their insurance company has negotiated in a contract a better deal for a drug that otherwise would not be appropriate. And then every January when the insurance plans negotiate different contracts with their pharmaceutical suppliers, coming back to the black box, then what does it do? It creates another big administrative churn because all the patients go to their pharmacist and the pharmacist says, your plan has changed, you need a new prescription, I've got to fax it to Dr. Wood, Dr. Wood's got to get it back to me. In the meantime, the patient may be sitting there without their medicines. Those are things that we could do better. We could do those in the context of changing how we do things in Minnesota, again, to achieve affordability and predictability and sustained relationships. Now, when we think about the opportunity, Ms. Perret said earlier today, we want to reallocate. I don't think that's what she meant. I think she meant we want to be able to reduce the spending total. Now, in the United States, in the Medicare program in particular, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission has just completed a report that indicates that about a third of Medicare spending is unnecessary. For most of the reasons I showed you in the example of coronary revascularization, those dollars could be reallocated to primary care, but some of those dollars should not be spent. So there are opportunities for us to manage our spending, again, with rational thinking and with the creation of the systems that would help doctors and patients make better choices. And I would say if you go way back to 1992 or a little earlier when we were, in fact, creating the Institute for Clinical Systems Integration, our goal then was to try to find ways that we could put in front of patients and physicians the exact same information about what's the right thing to do, so that patients would not be arguing to the physician, you're not doing this because you're going to get paid more to do less for me. We now have the ability to get this information in front of both patients and physicians to help make better decisions, but we need to make it easier for both of them to do that. Now, if we thought about our spending, right now we're spending about $6,000 per person in the state of Minnesota. If we reduce that by $600, multiply that by the population, you have a couple of billion dollars minimum. Is that hard to do? In reality, I don't think it is. I have shared with you the results about bypass surgery. You can say the same thing about implantable defibrillators, knee replacements, hip replacements, spine surgery, and some other things. So we can make some pretty good decisions that would, in fact, help us spend our limited resources more wisely without adversely affecting the quality of care that any Minnesotan makes and make it easier for us to provide access to effective care for every Minnesotan at the same time. I'm happy to answer any questions or hear any comments.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wood. We have a question from Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Wood, appreciated your presentation, found it very informative. I'd like to go back to that shared decision-making, potential to reduce unwanted procedures, and you show without shared decision-making, 58%. With shared decision-making, it decreases 40%, about a 30% reduction. You know, the interesting thing, last spring I had an opportunity on an airplane to sit next to a cardiologist, happened to be from Cleveland, Ohio. We had about a 2 to 3 hour conversation on health care. I've written a little book about healthcare reform. It's 23 pages, not 2,700, by the way. But we talked about some of these things. And, you know, and one of the things that came up was the fact that the system almost pushes the doctor in some ways to select higher reimbursement procedures because over half the system is reimbursed by government government payments, and those payments on both Medicare and Medicaid, the doctor is basically losing money on every deal, and he's making it up in volume. So he comes along losing money all the time on the government reimbursement, and he looks at the procedures and says, well, I got to make money someplace in this system. So he starts, you know, selecting higher reimbursement cost procedures to make up for the losses he's experienced on the other side. Do you see that as a perverse incentive to make these types of decisions, Dr. Wood?
Dr. Wood.
Madam Chair and Representative Greenhagen, in fact, it is an adverse aspect or a perverse aspect of our system. And I referenced earlier the method that has been adopted by Medicare to set the prices. So we've spent almost two decades working on trying to get to precision, and I mean precision to the 100th decimal point on the input resources for pricing of services, when we in fact should have been saying, what do we want in terms of the output and the result? And it will take a change, but I think there is now a great opportunity for us to begin to make that change.
Madam Chair, just one comment. You know, I don't know how I wanted to state this, but well, let's put it this way. I see dealing with just cost as putting a lid on a boiling pot of water. You're not really solving the problem. And I'm more about wanting to turn the burner down, because just putting a lid on cost, the doctor ultimately, being a human being, looks at the system and goes the direction where he gets reimbursed at the best rate. And that, you know, and that's putting a lid on a boiling pot of water. We've got to start turning the burner down some way, and that's where reform comes in. And I'm not completely sure how to do that, but that's what I think is important. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, just to comment to Representative Grunhagen, I think that's exactly what Dr. Wood's been talking about here. How do you control cost? Not just by saying you can't, you know, we're not going to pay as much for per procedure, but by changing the way we pay and changing the way we incentivize care. So, you know, I think we're all kind of talking about the same thing here. But Dr. Wood, thank you for your presentation. I just wanted to ask you, there was a question before about medical malpractice, and I know that you have an opinion on that. So I just wonder if you would also, maybe you have a different view on that as a physician, but could you address that issue as, you know, how big of a cost driver would that be in Minnesota?
Dr. Wood.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, the malpractice concern has been raised for a couple of reasons. One has been the size of jury awards, and one has been what is the perhaps unmeasurable cost of defensive medicine. There have been a number of studies that have been designed to try to look at this. Most of them have concluded that malpractice, either directly in terms of jury awards or the contribution of defensive medicine, is actually a relatively small portion of total cost driver. I would suggest that there are some things perhaps that could be looked at in that circumstance, especially at a national level. But in other states, if you take Texas, in particular, the adoption of significant limitations on awards has not substantially reduced malpractice risks, and it was for the reason I think that Ms. Perry referenced. We have to make sure that medical care is safe and reliable, and that when you go to a hospital, you're comfortable that you'll not be harmed. So that's where we, from my perspective as a quality person, remember I direct the Quality Academy at Mayo Clinic, my concern is to do everything that we can to make health care safer and more reliable. I would offer perhaps another opinion, and that is that the malpractice system is not well set up to serve patients. It is adversarial, and for patients who are injured, if there is a clear injury and it is obvious that it was a problem that was related to delivery, there should be compensation that is fair and just and swift. The problem is that there may be patients who are injured, and I can tell you this from the perspective of being a reviewer for Medicare quality programs. I see a number of circumstances in reviewing to make recommendations to hospitals about how to improve their systems that reflect what you could consider to be malpractice, and I'm not sure they ever get to a malpractice attorney. So I will tell you that my experience here is perhaps biased because of my role as a quality improvement expert and my role in helping Department of Health and Human Services nationally to improve the safety of care. But that's my perspective.
Representative Abler.
Thanks, and welcome back, Dr. Wood, on Rochester Day, even, so that's kind of cool. There's a party later. I'll put in a, they can advertise their own party, I guess. But the shared decision-making thing, is there a way to export this so that it would become something we do, and can we incent, cajole, demand people to do it across the system, or is it just have to catch on like a good idea?
Dr. Wood.
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, it's, I think, fairly easy to implement. We could decide to pay a modest amount for it and consider that to be part of the total cost of care for an episode. In that circumstance, what we don't do is give people the chance to have that information or to spend the time with a physician who can give them a fairly clear perspective of what the options are. So I think we can do it and do it very reasonably in a relatively short period of time.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
So, I've heard your presentation and you convinced me we should do this. And is there a way to do it by July 1st of 2011 in our programs by creating some expectations or something? I mean, can we done that rapidly, do you think, in our system?
Dr. Wood.
Madam Chair and Representative Abler, I believe it can. You simply say for certain procedures where we know that there are options and good evidence to support that we will make a modest payment for that decision-making to occur before the episode of care, and you might actually then say that we would not pay a total episode of care unless there was evidence that the shared decision-making was done prior to starting the care.
Thanks.
Okay, Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on this, because I think this is a very important discussion, and I hope this committee further tries to collaborate together and say, what are some principles that we can all agree to move forward? Because the frustrating part, and Dr. Wood, I just want to thank you for your presentation. You are able to verbalize very complicated policy goals in a way that we can all understand. But too many times I've seen around here where one day somebody will support something and the next day will oppose that very issue because politics gets in the way. And, you know, we hear charged words like rationing and death panels and all these things that, in all honesty, were born out of bipartisan proposals years ago. And I hope before we get to that point, as a committee, that we try to come to a discussion in which we share certain principles as a committee, because I think I think we can agree on a lot of things if we just sit down, look at the policy aspects of it, and do that before it gets into the supercharged political environment that we will come into come May. So I'm hoping, Representative Abler, I completely agree with some of the thoughts you had with what Dr. Wood explained to us when it comes to making rational decisions, and I hope we can have a further discussion of that as a committee.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Hosh. Seeing no further questions or comments, thank you, Dr. Wood. And members, just want to remind you that we do not have committee next Wednesday, February 9th, because of the State of the State address. And with that, we stand adjourned. Thank you, members. Is there a list?